the direction that Google's going in. And if you read Google's documents, they make it very clear, like good EAT comes from the author explaining both sides of the argument and basically allowing the user to come up with their own set of beliefs about it.
I think it's just very important to stick close to the original search intent. So someone landed on your page because they have a certain question or want to know something. So make sure you provide content that answers those questions in the most, well, complete, trustworthy way.
Just take a look at holistically, not just what your new content looks like, but what does your whole domain look like, and see if there's opportunities to almost like rebrand or represent yourself in a new way to search engines if you have a lot of history.
Welkom. Je luistert naar de Growth Room. Deze podcastserie van Ook gaat over organisch digitaal groeien. Hier hebben we het over natuurlijke resultaten in zoekmachines en content marketing. Resultaten die zijn verdiend, niet gekocht. In deze podcast bespreken we het belang van organische groei, veranderingen en updates binnen zoekmachines als Google of Amazon en hoe je maximale output uit je digital marketing efforts kunt halen. Dit is de Growth Room, jouw maandelijkse update op het gebied van organic growth.
Mijn naam is Jurjen van den Broek en welkom bij de Growth Room, de podcastserie van Ook. I will switch to English now, because today we have a very special edition of our podcast series. I would like to introduce you to our guest Lily Ray, not from New York City, but from California. And she's an SEO professional who talks a lot about EAT, eat. And we're not talking about food, it's about Google. Next to Lily, we have our friend of the show, I would say, which is Laura Ekkelenkamp. You might know her from our former podcasts. Laura is experienced in SEO, working for a big retailer in the Netherlands. Also has to do with the EAT issues. So I think it will be a great talk about EAT and what it can do for you. We're going to talk about EAT, what it exactly is. What's the importance of EAT for commercial and non-commercial platforms? And we're going to get to know which sites are winning and losing due to EAT, but also because of the Google Core update from last week. We'd like to talk a little bit on that as well, because I think it's great timing to speak to you, Lily, and to see what you see and what you may expect in the coming days or weeks to follow. So let's see. Let's kick off with a short introduction by Lily, because who is Lily and how can we find you? Where can we know you from? Can you tell a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. So my name is Lily Ray. I'm the director of SEO at Path Interactive. We are a digital marketing agency based in New York City and Nashville. I lead the SEO team there. I've been doing SEO just over 10 years now. And lately, I do a lot of speaking and writing about what's happening with Google's core algorithm updates, who's winning and losing, working on a lot of different sites that have been impacted by these updates. So really kind of laser focused on recovering from core algorithm updates, particularly focused on implementing good EAT across a lot of different sites. So you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn, and thanks again for having me.
Cool, it's awesome. We were honored to have you on this show. The show is always about organic growth, and I think the last days are, working 24/7, looking into data. How does your life is about the last week because of the core update? How does it look like?
It's about the same. I spent all of Sunday and Monday pulling data to compile for a blog that I posted that showed winners and losers in the US, but it's a lot of work, you know. It's like I analyzed 1,000 sites, so take some time to put it all together.
Yeah, we will put a link in the show, because you analyzed like 1,000 sites, winners and losers in America due to the core update. It's really, really interesting for all our listeners.
Thank you.
So that's cool. Thank you for your introduction, Lily. And what you said, you talk a lot about EAT, whether it's at Brighton, whether it's for SEMrush. People find you and you talk about EAT. How do you explain EAT if you have to explain it in a boardroom at a company? What do you tell them? What is
sure,
it?
Sure, yeah. So it's an acronym that stands for Expertise, Authoritativeness, and Trustworthiness, and it comes from Google's documentation. about maybe 2014 was when they first implemented EAT in their guidelines. So this, it came from their search quality guidelines. And that's a document that they use to train human evaluators who basically check the quality of Google search results. And that's a publicly available document. You can find it online. And it mentions EAT something like, I don't know, 80 or 100 times throughout the document. Like, it's very heavily referenced. And it's basically their criteria for understanding if a website or a page demonstrates expertise, authority, and trust. And it's more important for websites that are considered Your Money, Your Life, which is another acronym that they use, YMYL.
Yeah.
So the more Your Money, Your Life your content is, the more EAT matters for SEO.
Yeah. And so is that a reason why, what I noticed, like mostly health oriented websites and financial oriented websites are having, well, I would say issues or have things to fix concerning EAT because they are Your Money of Your Life websites. Is that a good conclusion or?
Yeah, not everybody in the SEO community agrees with that, but I certainly do, just from what I've seen. There's sites that aren't necessarily YMYL in the traditional sense that have also seen big impacts. But from what I've seen in the 2 years that I've really been researching this pretty heavily is that these updates are disproportionately impacting Your Money, Your Life sites, particularly health sites, news websites, financial, legal. It's pretty clear from the data, especially when it comes to things like alternative medicine, natural wellness, fitness and nutrition. There's certain areas where Google really wants to make sure that they're surfacing the highest quality, most trustworthy content and not presenting information to the user that's potentially dangerous. So that's where I've seen the greatest impact.
Yeah, so it's really done by Google for the users of a website. And and what you also said is like they have human evaluators. How does that work?
Yeah, so they have, I forgot the exact number, but I think they conduct about 10,000 user tests with human search quality evaluators throughout the year.
Yeah, I think you're correct. 10,000, yeah.
It's a lot. And so these users are asked to look at various tests, essentially, that Google's rolling out to see how well the different versions of the test results meet the user's expectations in terms of what they're looking for a specific query. And when they're going through that process, Google asks them to think a lot about EAT, and they present, 20 or 30 questions that the user can think about as it relates to, is the content trustworthy? Is it unique? Is it something that you've never, seen before? Or is the grammar and spelling on the page good? And all these different criteria that they have to think about. And the human evaluators essentially produce a score that Google will then factor all that data back into their algorithms.
Ah, cool. And is this, could you, like the EAT, it's expertise, you said, authoritativeness and trustworthiness. Could you give like examples on that? What is expertise? What is authoritativeness? And what is trustworthiness? And can you measure that?
Mm-hmm. So there's different approaches for each aspect of EAT. So for expertise, we really focus on, for my team and I, when we're analyzing EAT, we think about who the author of the content is, if that author is credible and has the right credentials to be able to speak on that subject matter. Sometimes we have clients where they write about too many different topics and they're not true experts in those topics. In those cases, we might recommend bringing in outside experts or reviewers to help inform that content. And then just the brand as a whole. So some brands try to be experts in too many things, or maybe their blog talks about too many different topics that aren't really relevant to the company. So we really try to laser focus on the true areas that the brand is an expert in. When it comes to authoritativeness, Google has confirmed that PageRank and links are a factor in EAT. In fact, that's the only like specific signals that they've confirmed are ranking factors for EAT. So I think that's where the A comes in, the authoritativeness.
Yeah.
So really just like your backlink profile, what does it look like compared to your competitors? Have you been mentioned in the press? I like to check the knowledge graph and see if the entity or the authors are listed in the knowledge graph. And then with trustworthiness, it's kind of standard like UX type stuff. So, you know, is the website secure? Is there a good return policy if it's e-commerce? Is there a way to get a hold of somebody at the company? You know, those different aspects of whether you can trust a website or not come into play.
Yeah, cool. That sounds pretty logical. Yeah.
Yeah, you think.
And, does it always affect a whole website, or could it also affect parts of the website?
Yeah, that's an interesting nuance in Google's documentation. So they do say that EAT and YMYL can be applied differently for like pages, for experts, for the website as a whole. So I do think that there's like times when a website can venture into areas that are more your money, your life. And so EAT is going to matter more in those areas. But from what I've experienced over the past couple of years with these algorithm updates is that it really tends to be evaluated as a whole, like as an entity, the brand being an entity. If you're negatively impacted by some of these core updates because of a perceived lack of EAT, I think it's very hard for companies like that to perform well until they address their EAT problems.
Yeah. So they have to address it for the whole website.
Right. In some cases, yeah. In extreme cases. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, Laura, you've got also experiences in at this. What's your experience?
Yeah, actually, I completely agree with what you just said, Lily, because what we see for our clients is mostly health well-being related, so mental and physical health, sometimes even medical. And we see that if you're not completely EAT compliant on certain topics or certain pages, you will see ranking drops, for example, after a core update on those pages. But if it's a bigger thing, then it will affect your website as a whole, of course. So your entire visibility will decrease. And it also depends, like if you have certain parts of your website, like you said, that where EAT is more of a more important, more of a focus, and other parts that are not very much related to EAT, then you should focus on those parts on your website where EAT is important to increase your overall visibility again.
Yeah. And could it, either of you, could it work like this if you assumably been hit by a core update because of EAT and you work on a certain part of your website to improve your EAT? Mm-hmm. Could it be the case that that part of the website will gain traffic again, and the other part of the website that you didn't touch will still be on a lower level? What do you think, Lily or Laura?
I think it's possible in my experience. If you benefit from a core update, like the one that rolled out last week, yeah, you tend to see it pretty across the board for your content, for your pages. I haven't really seen like just one section of a website improve and the rest of the website not improve as much. It's usually pretty across the board in my experience. But I think some sites see different things. So for some sites, the core update may only affect a portion of their website. But what I'm really interested in and what I look at most with my data is what's happening on the domain level. Because if you look at certain patterns of websites that have really been impacted over the past couple of years, it's very extreme. It's like 80% increases or declines in traffic overnight. And that affects the whole website as a whole.
Yeah, I think we've also seen that for one of our clients. It's a non-commercial website, which is very much health related. And they took a big hit after the May core update earlier this year. And we made a lot of changes, but on specific pages. So we had like a cluster, which we wanted to optimize to see what the impact would be. And now after this core update, what's it been like 5-6 days, we see an uplift in traffic and rankings on various pages, also pages we didn't optimize. So it seems like there is a connection there, and it is a domain level thing. So this is very interesting. So it's only been a few days, of course, but we are definitely monitoring the progress for that that platform.
Yeah, it's interesting days, what we said.
Very, yeah. Yeah. Long time waiting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what you said, Lily. I mean, I read your piece about some, I think some website you worked on, like Healthline and Verywell Health, if I'm not mistaken. Luckily, we see at our end an uptake as well for the client, which we are all very happy with, of course. But the thing Laura mentioned, like you've got like commercial versus non-commercial platforms. How do you see the importance of each for those? Is that different or is that the same?
So just from my experience, I think, so a lot of people get, they get kind of hung up on the fact that EAT doesn't matter for every site, which I agree with. And I think it's much more important for specific types of websites. Like, not every website that's impacted by these core updates has an EAT problem. There could be a lot of other things that are impacting your site. So I always want to make it very clear that when we're working on recovering websites, that's just one aspect of it. And for some companies, it's much more important than, you know, another aspect. And for some companies, maybe the technical problems are much more important. But I do think it can be very important for transactional pages as well in e-commerce, but the role that EAT plays in those situations is different. So it's more of a question of like, do you feel good about making a purchase on that website? You know, if you look at in the US, we have like the Better Business Bureau, like do people have a good experience working with that brand? And, you know, can they return the products if they have a hard time with it? Or is there any like evidence of being a scam or anything like that on the e-commerce side? You know, on the informational side, it's much more about the information is the product. So it's like, is this something that I can trust my life with?
Yeah. And so for the commercial website, are review websites important for commercial websites? I mean, there are a lot of websites where you can leave a review. Is that important? I mean, I think that's a logical answer, actually, but you say yes. Yeah. So you do focus on the same things, whether it's commercial or non-commercial, except for the product is different. The product is delivering good content, non-commercial, and the other is delivering a good product and service for the commercial website. I mean, that's a bit...
Yeah, so for e-commerce websites, absolutely. That's one of the main things we focus on is things like, you know, Trustpilot or G2 or whatever other website reviews these companies and the experience that individual customers are having with making purchases on the sites. I think that's very important, using things like structured data and, you know, getting star ratings and all of that. But again, yeah, for informational sites, it's more about when you read the content, can you trust that it's coming from a good place? So like not mixing transactional and informational content too much, like not pushing your products on people is really important. And then just a lot of transparency on the page as well about where the author is getting that information.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's actually very, very interesting and important because one of our biggest clients, they are an e-commerce website, but they also have a lot of content. So it's kind of a hybrid platform. We're also responsible for providing the content. And we are very much looking into how we can combine like informational content on health, well-being, and relate it to the products and services without being, you know, too pushy or being too commercial. So we also have a lot of guidelines for that. And in Holland, we have the COAG-KAG, which is like an organization that is responsible for product claims, so health-related products. And they also regulate and check, you know, if your website is compliant to the rules. And we also take that into account. And it also relates to EAT, actually. So up till now, it's been good. So the core updates, they haven't really affected this website, but it's something we always keep in mind. If you talk about like a disease or an illness or something, we are very careful with linking that to products or making claims about fixes those products might provide.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And Laura, do you see a difference between the more informational website and the more retail website the last 2 days? I mean, we know that the content informational website is boosting in traffic right now because there were some improvements. What do you see at the commercial website? Do you see something happening there?
Well, in terms of impact after the core update, up till now, we don't see any impact for the commercial website yet. But, you know, the rollout is still happening, so we can't say for sure. But there's nothing spectacular or visible. And for the informational website, we do see an increase. But how big that increase will be, we'll have to monitor for the following days. But we did notice for the last few months, for the commercial website, we have a lot of EAT related content. So it's like well-being and health, but also more like beauty and personal care. So it's less prone to eat guidelines. And we do see some decreases in drops in positions rankings for the health related content. So we are looking into that. But after the core update, there wasn't like a bigger decrease or anything. So we do have to keep top of mind, but
yeah. And when are you too pushy to push your products? I mean, that's what you said, Lily, that if you push your product too much, yeah, that's not a good idea. But we know that a lot of companies would like that we push their product. And we said, no, you don't, that's not the way to go. But when is it too much? Could you explain that? Is
it doable? Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I made a lot of people really mad when I first presented that concept, because everyone's like, well, why are we doing blogs in the first place? You know,
exactly.
So there's an interesting example of a website called dietdoctor.com. It's not one of my clients, but I've been paying attention to their website for a long time. So they are a brand that encourages, or they sell the keto diet as a product. They have books and things like that. And the keto diet's very, very controversial, right? So it's not for everyone. There's a lot of people that think it's like not great for you. So what's really interesting about their pages is that they talk about all that on the page. So they present both sides of the argument. They present disclaimers. They say this isn't for everyone, but here's the benefits. And they heavily source, almost every sentence on the page has a source where it came from. Not only that, you can click on the source and it tells you the three different places where they got it from and how much they trust each source. Yeah. So it's a really great example of, like, even when it's not in your best interest, just to present the user with both sides and let them make a decision. I think that's the direction that Google's going in. And if you read Google's documents, they make it very clear, like, good EAT comes from the author explaining both sides of the argument and basically allowing the user to come up with their own set of beliefs about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can actually talk about like the heavier topics, but let people make up their own mind about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's interesting. And how does it work for, I've got two questions. How does it work for affiliate websites? We've got a lot of, in the Netherlands, a lot of affiliate websites. I guess they're in the US as well, where they earn money because of the links they have on their website that link you to other platforms where you can buy it, and they get a certain amount of percentage from the sale they do. What's your vision for affiliate websites concerning the EAT? Are they going to make it in the health and beauty industry, or is that should they do a different approach?
Yeah, it's one of the categories that's seen a lot of volatility over the past couple of years, and it really depends how you approach it. So actually, I just did a presentation over the weekend for Australia when I was analyzing Australian visibility of a lot of different sites. And I found one, it's called cozier.co, I believe. And it's an affiliate website, but it's a really, really well done affiliate website. So they make it very clear throughout the content, like, here's why this website exists. Here's the people that are going to be reviewing the products. This is the process that we use to review them. You know, we call all these different experts into the evaluation process, and throughout the content it says these links help our website make money, you know, their products on other people's websites. So it's just very, very transparent. I think that's perfectly fine.
Yeah,
that website's seen a lot of growth this year. Where it becomes a problem is when you're deceiving the user into thinking that something is an internal link and it's really an affiliate link. I think that's where the big problem is.
Yeah. I think a lot of websites did that years ago and still are doing deceiving. But they learned the hard way de laatste updates. Probably. Yeah, cool. And a little bit off topic, but I was thinking, you can make a lot of content. This is not especially eat related, this question. What role do you see for content to build your organic growth? You can make like content directly for the consumer when they have questions. We can all see data, what people are searching for. We can make content for it, but we can also make a lot of other content which is high in the customer journey, what we call it. What role do you see for that content for organic growth?
I think that's one of the most important aspects of implementing EAT properly, which is to show depth of expertise on a given topic. So figuring out all the different questions that people have at all of the different stages of the search journey and making sure that you're hitting on all those different topics. I think that's one of the easiest ways to prove that you're actually an expert in something.
Okay. Well, that's a good logical answer. Thanks. In one of your former publications, you mentioned that losing pages usually contain a call to action. Is your vision still the same? Let's say, is it necessary that informative content only contains information? So does it impact you? Does it impact EAT if you link to products or the shop from an informational page? It's a bit of a question we had early on, but what do you think about that?
So I don't think that having a CTA is always bad. I think there's a time and place for it. It's really a question of what role it's playing in the user experience and what role it's playing in the content. So if your entire conclusion of the informational piece is buy my book because I'm the expert and I'm selling you this book, like that's not a great approach. But of course, you know, websites need to make money and they need to drive people back to their product pages. So it's just about authenticity and whether the call to action is actually relevant to the content. But from my original research where I found that to be a problem, the calls to action were really aggressive and they also changed the tone of the article itself. So that's where I would be careful.
Yeah. Yeah. So my English is good enough, but keep it close to the consumer. No, yeah. what they want, don't deceive, be authentic,
And the page structure matters too. So another thing that we look at is how close to the top the call to action is, especially on mobile. If you force the user into trying to make a purchase or whatever your call to action is right off the bat before reading any of the content or really high in the content, I think that can work against you as well.
Yeah. And does it matter how many call to actions you have on one page?
I think so. If it's excessive, yeah, I think that's a problem.
Yeah, and it does also have, I can imagine, probably also has to do how much content you have. Maybe some topics can have lots of content, so then you can have a little bit more CTAs. And if you have just a little bit of content and you have like 5 CTAs, I think that's a little bit overdone.
Yeah.
Correct? Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So there's no rule about it. It's more just about usability. And if it's relative to the content and it makes sense because it's a long article, I think you can have more. But it's really like actually what my team and I work on when we think about this, it's less about the calls to action themselves and more about the language surrounding the calls to action. So if you're bragging about your company throughout the content or kind of forcing people into making a decision, I would pay attention to that. I think Google's doing a lot with natural language processing and they really want to make sure that the content is objective.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's just very important to stick close to the original search intent. So someone landed on your page because they have a certain question or want to know something. So make sure you provide content that answers those questions in the most complete, trustworthy way. And then if it makes sense to link to another page or include a CTA or link to your services or products, and it's like, yeah, it makes sense to the user. I think it's relevant, and then I think it may actually have added value.
So Laura, how do you bring it to practice when you have like for this big retailer in the medical sector? You have a team to make that makes a lot of content. But in the end, you have to bring organic revenue. That's your end goal, to bring the client sustainable organic revenue for the future. How do you work on this part with the call to actions, guide them to product they have to need to buy?
Must
you work on that with your team?
Yeah, well, we have on this website, we have different categories. So we have like one health related. So that's the important one for eat. And then we also have beauty care and like a baby category, more to baby care. And what we do for our more health related content, we're very careful with call to action. So we link to a lot of different articles and content within the same topic. So we create like topics, divide them into subtopics so people can read more. But we are careful with linking to products, very careful. So we also have training for that, so everyone knows, you know, how to handle that. Also with the Dutch, like the Koch Koch organization, with the product claims. And then for the content that's more like beauty related, we don't have the same issue. So we are free to link to products and use CTAs as long as they're relevant, of course. So the health is not necessarily the biggest category in terms of revenue from content. But it's important to build your brand authority because it matches the brand very well. So people come to this website to read about that stuff. And then, of course, they're on the website. So they will probably also navigate to other pages and maybe come back next time. And there's also a big like ROPO effect. So the people who research online read a lot about the health stuff on that website. And then they go to the store to ask for more information or do a purchase there. So we also see a big effect there for the health-related content.
Yeah, cool. How do you do that, Lily, with your teams for clients to make them eat compliant? What are your tactics to help clients on that, to do it themselves, to understand it, to have your team on a high level on this part? What are your tactics?
A lot of different things. So there's never one approach, one uniform approach for every client. It's going to be different depending on the client. So in some cases, we have a situation where maybe there is an expert at the company and they are speaking at conferences. Maybe it's the CMO or something like that. But that work that they're doing is not represented well on the website. And maybe they have a blog happening, but it's that person's not involved in the content creation process. Like there might be a disconnect. So a lot of the time it's understanding or educating the organization about, we need to prove that these experts that work at your company are part of the website content creation process. Even if it's just like the expert reviewed this content, they agree with it, like implementing those signals on the page. That's one thing that we do. Another thing that we do for websites that have been negatively impacted is it's really hard work. Like it's a lot. People like to think that it's just some switch that you put the author's name on the page. That's like not even remotely what we the amount of work that we have to do to fix things. So like we have what we call content quality audits, and we basically take the guidelines that Google's presented about what it means to be high quality, and we run through every piece of negatively impacted content. Line by line,
every piece, line by line. That means hundreds of hours of work.
Yep, that's how much it takes. That's how much it takes. There's no way around it. And one of the biggest winners on my list is one of our clients, and we've been working on it all year. So it's very rewarding.
And did you see the impact? The first impact after core update, or did you already see an increase before that?
So it was about 10 to 20% growth maybe over the past several months. And we weren't expecting a core update this year, but we knew one day when the core update came, we were finally going to see the impacts of our work. So we were very excited this week. It was like a 150% increase in traffic overnight. So
oh, really? Oh, that's really
cool. It's been
cool.
A good week.
Oh, wait.
Very rewarding.
Very rewarding.
Christmas present.
It was literally like we were not expecting this week, but the client's like, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's like, finally.
Amazing.
Oh, that's awesome. I can totally understand. That's worth a big party.
Absolutely. For all COVID style, but.
COVID style, exactly. That's true.
Zoom party.
It's hard work. I mean, that has cost you hundreds, probably more than thousands of hours even. So it's hard work, but it's rewarding in the end. So, but how do you, I mean, you said you educate people at the client side. But how can you, CMOs, CEOs can get a little bit stubborn and they want to see results within a half a year, let's say half a year, if they're a bit educated. But if you're not giving them results, how do you cope with that? You know, the core update is needed to bring the real growth. How do you cope with clients that are, well, wanting
impatient
yeah. clients? Exactly.
It's a good question. I mean, it's one of the hardest parts of my job with the nature of sites that we've been working on, that you have to educate them up front. So with different SEO strategies and different SEO situations, the rate of growth that you can expect during a given time frame is going to be different. So if it's a brand new website that hasn't had any like manual actions or algorithmic, you know, issues or anything like that, you might be able to see growth in a few months or even a few weeks, depending on the category. So we make that clear to the client when we're analyzing, you know, the situation with our new clients. If you've seen 80% declines because of the May core update or whatever, you have to understand you're not going to get that growth back. It's just not going to happen until the next core update or maybe the core update after that. So it's just a matter of educating the clients. Some of them aren't patient. Some of them can't wait. But usually what happens is if they decide to not work with us because they can't wait, the next core update rolls around and maybe they're seeing, you know, more negative impact or maybe a positive impact from some of the work that we've done. And then they start to believe like, oh, that's actually how it works. I have to wait a long time.
Yeah.
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 So mostly the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Is what they say. Yeah?
The proof is in the pudding. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
But it's hard. I can relate to that. It's hard work with impatient clients. They want to understand, but you have to educate them how it works.
Yeah.
To what level do you educate? Is it also C-level that you educate?
Yeah, I do that a lot. It depends on the situation. Like with these core updates, the C-levels often get involved. Like, what is going on here? You know, I'm like, well, this is the situation. This is how Google works, and you're going to have to wait. There's just no alternative. There's some short hacks you can do to get spikes in traffic, like Google Discover or Google News or, you know, other viral content. But systematically, you have to wait for the next core update. So when it's big fluctuations to the business like that, the C-levels will often get involved. But normally, there's some type of internal SEO or advocate at the company that will have those conversations internally.
Yeah, cool. And would it be enough when you are from the EAT perspective, if you're the aid of authoritativeness is really high, if you see your backlink score and all the tools you can use, it's really high. Could it be high enough to be not impacted by an EAT or a core update? So you don't have to work on your expertise because your authority is just brilliant. Could that be a case?
I think it could be the case, but you still have to do SEO properly. So like sometimes there's situations where the author is very credible and well-known and has a good reputation and has all the great links and everything like that, but maybe they're not communicating properly on the site, like what those credentials are, or maybe they, you know, in the content, they're not structuring it well for SEO. So I think there's still a level of SEO, you know, optimization that has to be done on a site to convey all those things properly for search engines. So I just actually worked with a client who's a huge thought leader in his space, and his website was never architected to show that. It was during COVID that he needed to like finally work on his website. So we just had to take a lot of those, you know, offline data points and just make sure that they were conveyed on the site.
Oh, cool. Do you have any questions on that, Laura, for Lily?
Or Well, I'm actually, I'm interested, you already mentioned there's hundreds of things you can do to optimize to be more EAT compliant. But do you have an example of like something that you can pinpoint? Because, you know, if you start experimenting, it's sometimes hard to tell, you know, which optimization made the biggest impact. But do you have any example or anything where you say this is definitely one of the most important things to do?
Yeah. I like to take the domain name. Google actually says to do this in their documentation. So you can take the domain name and then put things like scam, reviews, like different aspects of how searchers and customers feel about the brand. And then you can subtract in the search result, the search query, you know, any results that come from that website. So look at third party reviews and what people are saying about your site and things like Google My Business reviews and everything. So just to get a sentiment about the brand, that's one thing you can work on. Another thing too is to do knowledge graph optimization. So try to make sure that your brand and your experts are listed in the knowledge graph and that all that information is tied together properly. So you can use structured data to like link someone's LinkedIn page to where they're mentioned on your website, things like that.
Exactly. That is really interesting. And how would that work if you have, for example, we have this one client, which is a really big name in this industry, health related, and we don't necessarily have specific authors or experts for content pages. So it's like almost like the brand's authority reflects on the pages. So if you would have a knowledge graph, it would be the brand and not a specific person. Do you think this will hold up in the future because Google will, you know, I think will become stricter and stricter and look more into this? Or do you think for every brand, in the end, it will be necessary to have these specific experts on specific topics matched to their content?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of people ask me that because a lot of brands don't want to say who the authors are for whatever reason. And actually, if you look at the structured data type for person, or sorry, for author, it accepts organization as a form of an author. So you can write things on behalf of an organization. But what I would do in that case is I would make it really clear to the user why you're not listing individual names. So like, this is our editorial process as a brand. This is what the brand stands for. Maybe if you can list the people on the leadership team at least or something.
Exactly. So be transparent about every choice you make.
Exactly.
And communicate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
Cool. Thank you, Lily. Well, the question I have left is about the winning and the losing websites. I mean, we talked about it earlier in this for this podcast. What is it? What you see? We talked about some winners because so in Healthline, PeriHealth, FeriWell Health. Do you see some losers as well? And what are the losers? And what are some winning websites you could advise us to look at because they are really doing a great job?
Yeah, so when it comes to the losers, this time around at least, I think it's really important for people to understand that loser doesn't always mean you've done anything wrong. Yeah, you know, sure. In some cases when you lose 70% of the traffic, that's probably an indication that Google has a problem with your website. But with this week, for example, some of the biggest losers are like the New York Times and Pinterest and Amazon, actually. Amazon is actually the biggest loser that we're seeing, I think, around the world in a lot of different visibility indexes. So
they were actually the big winner in the previous update, right? In the May update.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so what I think we're seeing this time, this is just my own opinion, but actually I've done a presentation twice this year in the last few months about the biggest winners of 2020. And almost all the biggest losers of last week are the biggest winners of 2020. So what I think that Google might be doing, again, pure speculation, I think that some websites and some organizations benefited disproportionately during coronavirus. So Amazon, New York Times got to rank for everything in the US as related to coronavirus and politics and everything. CDC is actually one of, if you look at the Center for Disease Control this year, There was a point when Google started to rank them for everything health related, just to be safe. They've seen a big decline this week. So it's not that the sites have done anything wrong. My perspective on it is just that, and the timing is interesting with the holidays. Like, I wonder if Google isn't like correcting things a little bit so that this coronavirus impact isn't as extreme as it was a couple of weeks ago.
Makes sense. And from this impact, we're like 1 week later almost. Is it hard to tell? Are the winners and losers really the winners and losers, or could there something be changed the next coming days?
In my experience, even starting with the hour that the algorithm update rolls out, the patterns that you see week over week tend to hold up for a few weeks. So everyone's like, oh, you published this so early. I'm like, just wait. You're going to see the same pattern for the most part. Maybe there's some exceptions to that, but yeah. I've already checked a few times since I published it, and it's still the same pattern. And some of the clients that we're seeing recoveries that I'm working on are seeing even bigger recoveries now. So it could become more extreme in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
So cool. It's actually safe to already communicate this carefully to your clients.
In my experience, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Depends how risk tolerant you are, but
yeah.
I'm pretty confident these numbers will hold up.
Yeah. Well, that's good news. That's good news for a lot of them. So that's good. Last question from my part. 2021 is coming up. What is your biggest or your strongest advice for companies to work on this coming year?
I think one of the biggest aspects of what we focus on this year that's been working for us is, like, a lot of sites have been around for 15 or 20 years at this point, and maybe they've had a lot of different SEO people working on the site over the course of time, and a lot of different strategies and philosophies about how to do SEO. And maybe now they're in a situation where there's like so much content, so many coverage issues in Google Search Console, you know, technical issues, just like legacy baggage that and links too. Maybe they bought links 10 years ago. So a lot of the work that we do is cleaning all of that up and like making it so search engines spend less time crawling through things that don't matter. So I think just take a look at holistically, not just what your new content looks like, but what does your whole domain look like, and see if there's opportunities to almost like rebrand or represent yourself in a new way to search engines if you have a lot of history.
Yeah. That also means you have to look at your crawl budget.
Yeah, you can look at your crawl stats, look if Google's wasting time on things that don't matter, which tends to happen really often. And they have a new crawl stats report in Google Search Console, which is really helpful.
Yeah. Finally, some insights.
I know. I saw sites that were big beneficiaries of the update. They saw a lot of crawl stats, more crawls happening in the days before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Laura, do you have something to ask for Lily to your last question, or
are you? Well, okay? I think we've answered a lot of questions already. So for me, it's pretty clear.
Cool, well, Lily. Thank you so much for being on the show today. So this was it for us for now. It was a real pleasure to talk to you and to hear your insights. I'm really going to dive into dietdoctor.com, kosher.co. Really interesting to give our listeners a voice from California to have inspiration and to grow organically even further. For the listeners, this was the podcast, the Growth Room, for today. Thank you for listening. If you don't want to miss out the next episode, subscribe to our YouTube channel or follow our podcast, Growth Room, also accessible at Spotify, of course. So thank you very much.
Bedankt voor het luisteren naar onze podcast. Hopelijk ben je weer een stukje wijzer op het gebied van organische groei. Wil je de eerstvolgende aflevering niet missen? Abonneer je dan op ons podcastkanaal, The Growth Room. En laat het ons ook weten als er een onderwerp is wat jij graag terug hoort. Meer weten over Ook? Kijk dan eens op www.ookisnow.com. Fijne dag!